this is Monocle Reads and I'm Georgina Godwin. Last night, the winner of the Women's Prize for Fiction was announced. Now, in its 25th year, the prize celebrates excellent originality and accessibility in writing by women in English from across the world. And in 2020, it went to Maggie O'Farrell for her novel Hamnet. Maggie is the author of the Sunday Times number one best-selling memoir, I Am, I Am, I Am, and eight novels, After You'd Gone, My Lover's Lover, The Distance Between Us, which won a Somerset Maugham Award, The Vanishing Act of Esme Lennox, The Hand That First Held Mine, which won the 2010 Costa Novel Award, Instructions for a Heatwave, which was shortlisted for the 2013 Costa Novel Award, This Must Be the Place, which was also shortlisted for the Costa, and of course this latest one, Hamnet. Maggie, many people were shocked that you were left off the Booker Prize list. So were you surprised to have won this award?
Well, I certainly wasn't shocked at all. I mean, the thing about prizes is you can't approach them with any sort of sense of expectation or, you know, even entitlement at all. You can't ever expect, you know, having been on both prizes, sort of both sides of prizes now, you know, especially having been on juries, you know, whatever books are shortlisted and whichever book is chosen, ultimately, it's so much about luck and so much about having all the right stars aligned. And, you know, it is just the books on a shortlist do reflect the taste of the five or six people in that judging room. You know, it isn't an entirely subjective procedure. So it just feels incredibly lucky if you get any kind of shortlisting or longlisting or anything at all.
So winning this one, how did you feel?
Well, it hasn't really sunk in at all. And I was totally blindsided when they told me. There was no particle of me that expected it, you know, that they were going to choose Hamnet. So I was totally, totally floored. But it feels, you know, it feels a little bit unreal, really, actually. But it's just so joyous. You know, I mean, I kind of feel that everybody on the shortlist is a winner, really. You know, just being in that, it was such an amazing feeling, actually, throughout most of lockdown to know that I was in this sort of very special gang of six people and six, because they were such diverse and such different books, you know, coming from such different perspectives and different times and different geographies, you know, but it was such a joy actually throughout lockdown to reread some of them, because some of them I read before, and also read new ones, which I probably would never have come across before. But I think that's the beauty of prizes, actually. I mean, I think prizes are, they're not really for the winners. They're not really for the shortlistees. They're for readers. They're for audiences. You know, the purpose of prizes, which they fulfill so brilliantly, is to open up our reading choices, you know, to suggest things to us when we're in a library or in a bookshop, and it wouldn't normally be a book that we would pick up. So I think that's the purpose of prizes, and I think they fulfil it beautifully.
Now, your winning book, Hamnet, is set in England at the time of the plague, the bubonic plague, and it's a study of grief as the disease kills off the young son of William Shakespeare. Where did your fascination with Hamnet, his son, spring from?
Well, actually, it sprang a very, very long time ago, almost 30 years ago, and I was 16 and I was studying the play Hamlet at school for my Scottish Highers. And I had an absolutely brilliant English teacher. I was really, really lucky, called Mr. Henderson. And he just told us in passing one day, and I suppose I should say that the play Hamlet really got under my skin, as I think it can do when you're an adolescent, or certainly a certain type of adolescent, probably given to a bit of introspective, melancholic rumination, and probably likes to wear black. And I was certainly one of those. So the play had really, really, I don't know, it had really spoken to me. I felt that Hamlet, the character, the Prince of Denmark, was a sort of, he felt like he was part of my own sort of DNA. I felt like I could relate to him very strongly. And in fact, there is, I went to a fancy dress party when I was 16 and I did dress as Hamlet. There is a photograph of someone which I really hope will never come to light. My teacher mentioned in passing one day that Shakespeare had a son called Hamnet who had died at the age of 11, and that Shakespeare had gone on several years later to write this play. And I don't know why, I was just very struck by this and the parallel symmetry of the names. You know, I have a very strong memory of looking down at the cover of my very battered school Arden Shakespeare and just putting my finger over the L in the title and just thinking, well, it's the same name. And, you know, even though I was very, you know, I was only 16, it struck me as a very significant act to call a play and a hero, and also not forgetting a ghost, after your dead son. You know, I studied literature at university, and of course, you know, I studied Shakespeare and read a lot of criticism, biography and scholarly work on him. And I remember then, even though I was a long way off, you know, from being a parent myself at that point, I was very struck by how little mention Hamlet got. You know, I felt that he was totally overlooked and totally underplayed. You know, his significance was very much underplayed. You know, in these enormous sort of brick-like biographies of Shakespeare, he would be lucky if he got maybe two mentions, tiny mentions. They'd mention that he and Judith had been born, and then they mentioned that he died. And usually his death was always wrapped up in statistics about child mortality in Elizabethan times, which of course was very high. There was no shortage of things that could kill you then. And it almost as if the implication, sort of unspoken implication, was that it sort of wasn't that big of a deal because children died all the time and parents would have been half expecting it. And that really, I don't know, it really pierced me, because I thought, what a presumption. How could you assume? I mean, he was 11, you know, he was on the cusp of adolescence. You know, they've had him all his childhood. How could they not have grieved? How could they not have been subsumed? And you only have to read the opening scenes of Hamlet to realise that the whole play is underpinned by this enormous sense of grief and this enormous sense of loss. And yes, it isn't a literal translation of the death of a young boy, but it's there. You can see it if you want to look for it.
Mm. In your book, you never actually name Shakespeare. Why is that?
No. Well, I mean, partly because, you know, it's him and we all have, you know, he's, I mean, it's sort of pointless to say, it seems spurious to say, you know, he is the greatest writer who's ever lived. But also he's sort of part of all of us in a sense. You know, he pervades our very language and he forms, you know, he's completely changes the way we think about ourselves and our relationships to others. And he continues to do so with every single new production I see. There's always something new that you can see or something that speaks to you, but, you know, as you move through life in a sense. And also, you know, I found it as a writer, I would sit down and I'd be writing a scene and then I would attempt to write a sentence, you know, like, I don't know, William Shakespeare sat down and had a cup of milk, you know, and it's just instantly you feel like an idiot. And, you know, you as a writer, I was getting pulled out of the book and the narrative. And I thought, well, I can't expect readers to stay subsumed in the narrative if I can't even do that. So it was just distracting. So I decided that I would just not name him at all, because his name carries so much weight, you know, it's so freighted. But also, I suppose, in a sense, I wanted with the book, in a way, to divorce him from what we know about him. You know, I don't want him to be Shakespeare, the writer and the icon, and this, you know, enormous behemoth. Just, he's a man, he's a father, he's a husband. You know, I wanted to tell a story that hasn't been told before, or make up a story, I should say, because it is fiction. So I wanted readers, in a sense, to sort of park what they think they know about him and open themselves up to this new fictional vision of him, in a sense.
Now, plague is the reason that Hamlet dies, and you actually trace the journey of an infected flea that boards a ship in Alexandria. Could you see parallels with the disease then and the pandemic that we're facing now?
Well, I should probably say that it's not known what the real Hamlet Shakespeare died of. There's just a record of his burial in the parish records in Stratford-upon-Avon, but there's no record of death. So the plague in the book Hamlet is a kind of invention of mine. You know, it's possible that he died of plague. He died in high summer in a plague year, so it's not unlikely. But as I said, you know, there was no shortage of things that could have killed you. But my character, Hamlet, dies of the plague. I mean, partly because something that's always intrigued me about Shakespeare is that he never ever once mentions what we now call the plague in any of his plays or poetry, which is extraordinary when you think how prevalent it was in those days and how it must have been at the forefront of every single Elizabethan's mind. You know, it was a constant threat and a constant terror for them. You know, every single one of them would have known exactly what the signs and symptoms were and exactly what would happen if there was a case in your house. You know, you would have had a watchman stationed at your door for 40 days. No one was allowed in or out. You know, whole towns were shut down. I mean, Shakespeare himself, his career was constantly interrupted by the plague. You know, the first thing the civic authorities would do was to close down the playhouses. I mean, if you think the original Globe had a capacity for 3,000 people, and you know that they were all gathering in the midday in summertime in the hot sun, you know, you can see why they were considered viral hotspots. So he would have, you know, he would have had to either go on, take his company on tour if the plague wasn't too big an outbreak in sort of surrounding towns and counties around London, or he would have probably gone home to Stratford. So it's just always begged the question to me, why does he never mention it when it's such, you know, he never reaches for it in all the kind of enormous range of his metaphors. I mean, he talks about pestilence, he talks about a plague as in a plague on both your houses, but that doesn't mean what we now call the Black Death. And it's always this absence, it seems to me a very glaring absence, it's always made me ask, well, why? Was it too close to him? Was it too painful? It's possible. But no, I mean, it is odd now, looking back at that chapter where I trace the sort of path of the disease coming towards Warwickshire, you know, because obviously when I did it, you know, I had no inkling, I mean, none of us did, that, you know, what was about to happen. Nobody could have foreseen the COVID pandemic. But in a strange way, you know, I mean, it is odd, you know, because when I think about because when I was constructing that chapter, it was just an act of research, really, and imagination. And, you know, I remember sitting in my, you know, centrally heated house in my ergonomic office chair thinking, I wonder what it feels like, you know, to know that there is this deadly disease coming towards you, coming towards your country. I was looking at, I had all these maps pinned up on my study wall, which showed trade routes, you know, Elizabethan trade routes, and where the ships would have stopped and what they were picking up and what they were dropping off, you know, spices and furs and silks and fabrics and China. Now, when I think about those maps, they look just like the infographics that we were all looking at, you know, in February. And, you know, I remember that feeling of waking up that morning and looking at the news and it being reported that, you know, the COVID had reached Italy. And at that point, of course, you know, we knew that it was going to come here. It was only a matter of time. So it is strange looking back, because I think normally when you finish a book, you know, as soon as you put the last full stop and you shut the document, your relationship, in a sense, is over. You know, it's your relationship with that book is set in stone and it's finished. Your part in it is done. But with this book, I feel my relationship with it, having lived through the last 6 months, you know, the challenges and the ups and downs of it all, I feel that my relationship with the book has changed in a way. You know, I feel closer to the Elizabethans in a sense. I mean, obviously, you know, COVID there's no comparison between a population undergoing a Black Death pandemic. I mean, it killed a quarter of the world's population. You know, I mean, the devastation it wreaked was horrifying. And, it, you know, I think we have to remember that we are lucky to have modern medicine and ventilators and hospitals. And so, you know, obviously there isn't really a comparison, but I think it's certainly in terms of having gone through the fear of it and this idea of lockdown and this isolation and this strange sort of, the strange sort of distance between us and other people, you know, both physical and mental, I think, you know, it brings you closer to past populations.
Now, within the literary crowd, the Women's Prize for Fiction is known to have the best party every year. And of course,
it's very true.
It didn't happen this year. So how was it for you winning in a way that couldn't really be celebrated?
Well, it was a funny one, and yeah, it's very sad that the party didn't happen. But you know, it would be pretty churlish to focus on that negative part of the experience. Oh, what a party! It's a bit Veruca Salt, isn't it? So no, I mean it's a shame, but I'm sure at some point we'll try and all get together and raise a glass. But it's a shame. But you know, it's you can't have everything, and. I feel like I've got quite a lot today.
Finally, the question that I do have to ask, it's been asked a million times, but I'm interested in your take on whether you think prizes like this still need to be gender specific.
Well, I think it's an interesting question and certainly one worth considering. But, you know, I think we have to always remember that there are, I mean, two things really, that all prizes have criteria. You know, there are prizes which are for books about medicine and prizes for first novels or biographies. So I think every prize does have a criteria and needs one in a sense. But also, you know, I think it's really hard now, 25 years on, of 25 years of the Women's Prize, to remember that back in 1996, when Helen Dunmore won with A Spell of Winter, you know, I mean, I was starting to write my first novel and I was also working as a sort of editorial assistant on the books desk of The Independent on Sunday. And, you know, in those days, Helen Dunmore did not and would not have got the coverage that her male counterparts, you know, Graham Swift or Ian McEwan got at that time. But you see now, in 2020, it's unthinkable that Hilary Mantel or Bernadette Evaristo or Tayari Jones wouldn't get that because, so in a sense, so the Women's Prize has achieved an enormous amount. You know, there has been an enormous redress of that imbalance, but there is still a long way to go. There are still many steps to be taken. And I don't just mean in terms of the literary world. Obviously, you know, worldwide, there are still enormous and horrible inconsistencies and inequalities for men and women. So, you know, so much work has been done, so much ground has been covered, but there is still quite distance to go.
Maggie, very many congratulations to you.
Thank you so much.
Hamlet by Maggie O'Farrell, winner of the Women's Prize for Fiction 2020, is published by Tinder. And you can hear a full interview with Maggie in our Meet the Writers archives. You've been listening to Monocle Reads. Many thanks to the team of Nora Hull and Sam Impey. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.